So, right, I think by this late in the program, we'd know what the structure of glasses are, so hopefully we won't find this a redundant discussion. I do want to thank the organizers once again very much for inviting me here. It's been a really stimulating activity. So, in the spirit of managing expectations, we had some comments from the last speaker about theory versus experiment, and so I'm not only a metallurgist, but I'm also an experimentalist, so we'll see how this works out for you. I will work to be a little more lyrical and imaginative, I suppose. I will use experimental data, but I've collected none of it, so it's all been taken from the literature to sort of support some of the structural concepts that I'll be describing. I want to start with some earlier insights from the literature, reading through the literature. A number of people had done some really exceptional work and drew from that some very keen insights. So I just want to put some of these on the table as we start. Correlated rather than random arrangements of local structural units. We can no longer assume or talk in the seductive simplicity of randomness alone. Let's see. The amorphous state is in reality not a disorder state, but a rather well-organized arrangement of atoms. And let's see, structures that are more complicated, more diverse, and more ordered, in, at least in the sense that there may be an underlying ordering structure-forming principle. So a lot of insight earlier that sort of began to tip the hat that metallic glasses are not random, close-packed, hard sphere structures, but something else is going on. And so I'll be talking about our attempts to try to rationalize that and to describe a simple three-dimensional static structure that incorporates those sorts of ideas. I'll start with a summary just to give you a little bit of an idea of some of the main ideas that I think are important to characterize metallic glass structures. Atomic packing is efficient over both local and global length scales that can be established experimentally. There are strongly preferred relative atomic sizes, and there is not only strong short-range order, which isn't surprising, but there's also an exceptional degree of medium-range order as well. The atomic size distributions, we've heard a lot about polydispersed systems, monodispersed, and so on. Metallic glasses are basically bidispersed, tridispersed, or quaddispersed. I don't know if that's the right word. And I'll describe for you the physical basis for that observation. We've looked at hundreds and hundreds of different metallic glass systems, some of them with as many as seven or eight different atoms, chemically distinct atoms, and there are never more than four different atom sizes. And solute concentration is probably not so important. Okay, so those are some of the main findings. This Franz, yes, I had my elephant story as well. I'll just skip through that. You've heard the parable already. But for the benefit of those who ask the question, why don't we just measure the structure? I mean, we have some really, really amazing experimental capabilities, and certainly in crystalline materials, this wouldn't even be an issue. We'd just go measure it. And the main point of this view graph is that as soon as you give up translational symmetry, the experimental techniques that we have largely give you global average signals, and it becomes very, very difficult then to extract the information that we would like. There are some techniques that are being developed that are getting very close now to being able to give us some very useful information, a 3D atom probe and fluctuation microscopy and so on, but we're still not there. Simulation is also an exceptionally powerful technique. One of the things I like to say is that one of the most important strengths of atomic simulations is it gives you the XYZ coordinate for every atom in the system. The biggest weakness is that it gives you the XYZ coordinate of every atom in the structure. And you don't know what to do with that information. And so one of the things that I would offer as a potential benefit for the sorts of approaches that we're taking here is it gives you a way of organizing the way you interrogate the structure. And some people, Evan Ma has used ideas like this to great benefit in his computational research. Okay, so if you're going to develop a structural model, you have to be able to show a good agreement with measurements. And so I show here a range of different things that we need to pay attention to. Randomness is the defining feature, short-range order, medium-range order, efficient atomic packing over all length scales, and so on. What we have chosen to focus on is the efficient atomic packing as the structure forming principle. Not surprisingly, others have done that as well. Kepler, for example, we talked a little bit about this, the Kepler conjecture for the face-centered cubic packing of equal size spheres. Is what I would call a simple problem. Simple in the sense that the system is very well defined. Now, it took 400 years to solve that problem. It currently represents the longest unsolved problem in discrete geometry, and even now there's still arguments about whether Thomas Hales has actually solved that problem. The only point I want to make is that when we go to binary or more complex distributions, this becomes an immensely more difficult problem. And so how is it that you would define the structure, let alone define the way that you can most efficiently pack the structure as a function of the relative size of the spheres and the relative concentrations of the spheres? So it's a very, very daunting problem. We've collaborated with a number of mathematicians some years ago, and the bottom line was that they didn't even know how to pose the problem, let alone begin to address it. So what you'll see is, not being a mathematician and being far too wise to even try to dabble, we're taking an approach that I think is strong on insight and weak on rigor. So we've broken the problem up into two chunks. We started to ask ourselves, how is efficient packing achieved locally? And then in a moment, I'll talk about how we can enforce that globally in non-periodic systems. So a lot of this isn't new, but let me just go ahead and present how we develop it. If we look at the relative size, I'm showing this in two dimensions, relative size between two different spheres, we can go from a local coordination that intuitively and qualitatively we might say is efficiently packed. As we increase the size of the center disk, coordination number stays the same, but the packing becomes slightly less efficient until the size ratio gets to another point where you can get efficient packing in the first shell. And so Takeshi talked about this. So all of the pink ones are in contact with the blue one. Right. So again, Takeshi talked about this in his presentation. In terms of hard disks, we're constrained to have an integer number of coordination, but as you change this relative size, you can have what we call a theoretical coordination number, just given by this simple relation from Takeshi's work. And so we define the packing efficiency as the ratio of the actual coordination number, which is just the truncated value of this, divided by that value. And so if you look here, for some radius ratios, you have a coordination number of 3. This theoretical number increases like this, and so packing efficiency drops down, and it sort of ratchets. For well-known radius ratios, 0.414, packing efficiency is 1, and it drops down, and so on. So you get this ratcheting sort of behavior, and you see that there are very discrete radius ratios in two dimensions where you get efficient packing in the first shell, and I show some of those coordination states here. So one of our contributions was to take that simple idea and extend it to three dimensions where we idealize packing in the first coordination shell around a reference sphere. And just skipping over the details, we get the same basic result. We get a theoretical coordination number, and there are integer coordination states, and so the packing efficiency sort of ratchets like this. But the main conclusion for the purpose of this talk is that we are able to calculate these radius ratios where you get efficient filling of the first shell by equal size spheres. So again, this is a radius ratio, and this represents a center sphere of radius R, or R star, and then surrounded by 9, 10, 11, 12, or so on, unit size spheres. So this work was published some years ago, and we posed the approach. We said that if efficient filling of space was important in the stability of glasses, then there might be some statistical preference for glasses that used atomic species that had those particular radius ratios. And so we've done this a couple of different ways. In that paper, in fact, we looked at several hundred complex metallic glasses, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different elemental constituents, and looked at all the different radius ratios, and we get this histogram here. So this is the number of metallic glasses that had an atom pair with a particular radius ratio. And you can see very strong peaks, and the peaks occur pretty much right where we calculate those particular values to be. More recently, we've done this for an extensive assessment of binary metallic glasses, and we see the same sort of response. We see a rather strong preference for specific radius ratios, and those are the radius ratios that we've calculated based on this efficient local atomic packing. So this problem actually has been pursued in the mathematics community for over 100 years. It was initially motivated, I think, by the Thompson problem of charge distribution on the surface of a sphere. And so there are actually several, at least two generations of mathematicians that have worked this problem quite a bit. And there are closed form solutions as well, and they yield clusters much like this. And so taking the two results together, we could offer these sorts of atomic clusters, solute-centered clusters with solvent atoms in the first shell, as candidate representative structural elements in metallic glasses. So that's the first step. That's the approach that we've taken to rationalize the local structural unit based on efficient local atomic packing. And so the next question is, how do those clusters organize themselves in space to form a structure? And so I guess I just wanted to take a minute to address the question, why would we even expect them to organize in space? And so this is just sort of a hand-waving argument where I show a collection of binary spheres, atoms actually. And an important feature is that the atoms have different sizes and that there are differences in the bond strengths between the AA atoms, the AB atoms, and the BB atoms. And so we just we define a notional temperature scale, and at some very high temperature that's higher than E over K, and here I take E to be the most negative bond in the system, which I'll propose to be the bond between unlike atoms. So at some temperature, the thermal energy is higher than the most stable bond, and it's certainly a liquid, it's certainly a condensed material, but the bonds, and the coordination state around any atom is rather high, but the bonds are not stable with time. They're made and broken and remade over a very short time scale. As you cool down, you reach some characteristic temperature that's, let's just say, on the order of this most stable bond. And what happens is some of the bonds begin to persist in time. And I'm going to say again that those are the unlike atom bonds. And so what does that mean if they persist in time? Essentially, the minority species will want to surround itself with as many opposite species as it can. So you form these solute-centered clusters, and those clusters begin to persist in time. As you cool it down further, this is just a notional temperature scale, at some point the AB bonds not only persist, but they begin to percolate, and you start to form fragments of a topologically disordered network, and then eventually the whole thing sort of organizes. So that's just sort of a hand-waving argument on why the cluster should organize. And I'll mention, by the way, that there are a number of experimental observations that do in fact show that these clusters, atomic clusters, do form in the liquid, and they are quite stable at temperatures up to about 100 to 150 degrees C above the liquidus. So even in the equilibrium liquid, these clusters are known to exist. Okay, so now we ask the question, how are these going to, how might these clusters fill space? And the real insight came when we recognized that these atomic clusters, if you were sufficiently jet lagged and wasn't seeing quite clearly, that you could think of them as, idealize them as sort of like a sphere-like agglomeration of mass. And if you imagine them to be sphere-like and ask yourself, what's the most efficient way to fill space with these sphere-like clusters, you're drawn immediately to Kepler's conjecture as well, and that is efficient atomic packing of these clusters could be achieved if you organize them in space, something like an FCC sort of structure. I will say that we've looked at lots of different ways that these clusters might organize, and one of the most important things that I hope you take away from the talk is I'll show you that this can actually be measured directly with experimental techniques. And in our quantitative comparisons, we find, in fact, that the face-centered cubic arrangement does seem to be give the best agreement with experimental data. So I was going to do one other thing. So we've talked about bubble rafts, we've talked about packing of spheres. And I know you're not going to be able to see this, so you can just mention it or imagine it in your eye, but I've got a box of such clusters, these sort of icosahedra. And if you take them and put them in a box and just sort of shake them around, just in the same spirit of hard spheres and stuff, you'll see that this is what they do. They organize more or less in some sort of structure that is not random. So there are a couple of important consequences of the ordering of these clusters. So the first is that you get a number of distinct topological sites. So I've already introduced two structural species and two sites. The one species is the solute at the center of these clusters, and I'll call those the alpha solute. So that's both an atomic species and a structural site. That structural site is surrounded by solvent sites. And then we can also imagine another site at the center of an octahedron of these clusters. I'll call that a beta site. And then, of course, you can imagine there's also a gamma site at the center of a tetrahedron of these structure-forming clusters. So these are the four different topological species and four different sites that I mentioned before. And I said we've looked at hundreds and hundreds of different glasses and find that this seems to be quite well obeyed. I'll also propose that there are different sizes for these different structural sites, and I'll propose that the alpha site is the largest, the beta site is about the same size, and the gamma site is actually smaller than those others. Another important consequence is that in this manifestation, the solute atoms occupy more or less ordered sites. And they occupy that, and that order can extend over some length scale related to the intercluster separation. And so this was, when we proposed this was actually the first physical basis for describing the medium range order that had been measured 20 years earlier in metallic glasses. And I want to point out that the medium range order observed in metallic glasses is always between the solutes. It's the solute-solute, not the solute-solvent, not the solvent-solvent. And so this gave a good physical basis for that. Now, I want to emphasize that these clusters are not packed at the points of an FCC lattice. They approximate the point, but they have some length scale beyond which it becomes difficult to detect that order. And the reason is that the clusters are not equal size spheres. They're knobby. And so the intercluster spacing depends upon how those clusters are configured. Here I show two of them contacting a common face, and here contacting a common vertex. So you can see there's a different separation, and that leads to this breakdown of medium range order over some length scale that typically seems to be on the order of 1 or 2 nanometers. And then preferred atomic positions also introduce the possibility of defects that I'll talk quite a bit about. I do want to take just a point on the idea that there is some medium range order that extends over some length scale, but it's lost beyond that. In Western cultures, we tend to think in a dualistic sense. It's either ordered or it's not. And in fact, that's sort of represented in Napoleon's quote here, which you've probably already read. But of course, things aren't always that simple, and there are shades of gray in between. And I'd like to make a point of that because I think it's a fundamental aspect of these glasses, that you do have some type of order for some of the species, and it has some length scale, but it's not perfect order, and it's not a crystal, and you shouldn't treat it that way. But there is something there, and so that you shouldn't ignore either. So I think this is one of the intriguing aspects of the metallic glasses, that you do have this order-like behavior of a medium range, but it's not ordered. And then I also want to talk just a little bit more about the defects, because this, I think, is a very, very important aspect, because ultimately that will control a lot of the properties. I'm giving you a static view, but I think a lot of the dynamics are also controlled by these sorts of defects. So for example, in a simple two-dimensional view, I show these alpha-centered clusters. And although you might be able to put another solute in here, there aren't solutes at the present time. This is a little misleading. It looks like a big vacancy, but it's my sense that especially in three dimensions, you won't see such a big space. What happens is those atoms relax and you get sort of a locally distributed additional volumes. But if you try to force a solute in there, it will rearrange the solvent atom so that it can sort of fit, as I've sort of shown here. But even still, when you fill these beta sites with a solute, you still haven't formed contact between the solutes. And in fact, you can get to surprisingly large, or at least for me, surprisingly large solute concentrations before topology requires solute-solute contact. And so eventually, you put more solute in the beta sites, then you fill the gamma sites, and eventually the only sites you have left to fill are the solvent sites. And so as soon as you put the solutes on the solvent sites, now you start to form solute-solute contact, and that has some very specific implications in terms of the stability of the structure and probably on the dynamics as well. And so I'll make a point of this a little bit later. Okay, so I've given you the first two principles, preferred specific radius ratios, and then organization of the clusters. Two other things, there's no orientational order between the clusters. That's essential because that enforces randomness of the solvent atoms. Of course, if all these clusters had the same orientational symmetry, then it would be a crystal. And there are crystals exactly like this, by the way. If you take icosahedra and put them exactly at the points of an FCC lattice, that is the crystal structure for tungsten aluminum 12 and moly aluminum 12. So we say that these clusters do not have orientational order, and that's consistent with sort of a kinetically constrained process and quenching from the melt. These clusters don't have time to rotate with respect to their neighbors. And then finally, there are these preferred site occupancies. I probably won't spend much time on that right now, just in the interest of saving time. I do want to mention that the ideas that I've described here have since been validated in a number of simulations. Again, NMOS done some very, very nice work, and this idea of forming clusters and then organization of the clusters has been validated in his work, and he's extended that in definition of quasi-equivalent clusters as well. There is still some discussion going on about whether it's FCC-like structure or icosahedral structure, but that's always a nice discussion. Okay, so that's the basic idea in how we feel that the structure is being organized, and I want to emphasize that this it's a rich structural field. So if you have a number of different discrete atomic sizes and different sites that can be occupied, you can conceive of lots and lots of different glasses. I show a couple of different here, and I describe the structure of the glass by the coordination number around the different solute species. So 12 would be these pink icosahedra. 10 means I put a slightly smaller solute here, so when this goes in a beta site, it has 10 solvent nearest neighbors, and then the 9 is in the cluster octahedral site. And you can just sort of permute those and produce different structures just by varying the relative concentration and the relative size. So lots and lots of possibilities. We've actually enumerated close to 300 different structures that are conceivable just from a topological perspective. And so the question is, do all these topologies exist? And do they all have the same stability, or are some of them intrinsically more stable than others, and why? We started some years ago proposing that topological stability would be favored when the solute sites were filled by solutes that fit that site most naturally. And I want to emphasize the filled part. And also when the number of unlike atom bonds are maximized. This was a qualitative expectation, and in some cases, it's my sense that these have not been fulfilled, and we're trying to understand some of that now. So I'll go through rather quickly an approach on how we can quantify the structure, and the main point that I'd like to communicate in the next few charts is that unlike a concept that you might have in thinking of randomness, we can actually define the number of sites in the structure. We can define the preferred atom species for that, and then we can actually go and compare that and assign specific atoms to specific sites. Little surprising, and in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over this a little quickly. So in the way that I've described the structure, we have four different species, solvent and three different solutes. Four different sites, and so we have to define these site occupancies. These site occupancies are the number of I species that occupy a J site normalized by the number of alpha sites in the structure, which we can normalize considering that the clusters are packed in an FCC sort of configuration. So daunting task. We've got 16 of these guys to solve. We do know the total number of sites, as I mentioned. We can count that. For every alpha site, there's one beta site and two gamma sites from FCC symmetry. And the number of omega sites is just given by the relative size, the radius ratio between the solute and the solvent, as I mentioned before. So that's one clue. The biggest simplification is in looking at binary systems. So now we only have two atomic species. And then we've made some other observations in comparing with experiment, and a number of these terms go to zero. So we only have these five terms to to look at, and we can actually solve it then by solving for this term S bar alpha, which is given by simple accessible parameters, the atom fraction of alpha, and some of these topological terms. And then we also assume that the alpha sites are filled first by alpha, then the beta sites are filled, then the gamma sites, and then the solvent sites are filled last. Okay, so and these are what the structures might look like for different values of this term S bar alpha. Again, S bar alpha is the total number of alpha atoms in the structure normalized by the number of alpha sites. So if all the alpha sites are filled by alpha solutes and that's it, S bar alpha equals 1. If the alpha solutes fill the alpha sites and all the beta sites, S bar alpha equals 2. They fill the alpha, beta, and gamma sites. And of course, they, S bar alpha can be greater than 4, and it doesn't have to be integer either. You can have partial site occupancy. So I'm going to use this term S bar alpha in some of the other things. I'll skip over some of this. So I'll move now into just a couple of charts that show some quantitative comparison between predictions from this model and experiment. So one of the things that we can do is we can predict partial coordination numbers as a function of these topological parameters. These are the equations for the number of alpha atoms around alpha, for the number of omega atoms around alpha. And I apologize, you probably can't read this, but this shows a comparison for a number of different glasses between what we would predict from the simple topological model and what people have measured. And by and large, if you look at these pairs of numbers, you see they're basically within experimental error, which is typically in the order of plus or minus 10%. So we're able to predict the partial coordination numbers even if you have mixed occupancy in the first shell, and we can do that around both the alpha sites and the omega sites with pretty good precision. Most important thing is that you can explore the cluster packing symmetry using solute-solute partial pair distribution functions. The basic idea is if you have cluster packing like this, you just throw away all the solvent atoms and look at the solutes. You can define a structure factor, and the structure factor then you have to magnify by a length scale that has to do with the cluster packing, which we calculate just from simple Hartsphere geometry. And then I show here an experimental plot for the boron-boron partial pair distribution function. This was taken from Lamparter. And then I look at different structure factors, assuming that these clusters are simple cubic packed, hexagonal closed packed, body-centered cubic, face-centered cubic, and other non-periodic packings as well. And you'll see that we get best agreement between what we would predict based on the way that the clusters are packed with experiment if the clusters have this FCC sort of packing. We also get rather good agreement with icosahedral arrangement of the clusters as well. And again, I want to emphasize that these are not necessarily icosahedral clusters, but it's the clusters are organized in an icosahedral way. And we do this not just for the boron-boron, but we've looked in other glasses as well, and we find that same sort of agreement. We can also see when these alpha-alpha defects occur by the occurrence of the solute-solute nearest neighbor peak. Density we can predict, although not quite as well. We're within 20%, and so we're still working on that as well. And then the final thing that I'll leave you with is we've recently done an assessment where we've looked at a wide range of binary glasses. This actually was inspired by work that Takeshi had done many, many years ago. And so we've extended that. We found 175 different binary glasses. If you look at all the different elements that are composed and you look at the number of solutes and solvents, we actually find that of all the binary combinations that you could propose based on those, about 8% of them form metallic glass systems, which was surprising to me. I had always thought that metallic glasses were a highly unusual occurrence, but it turns out that they're really not that uncommon. So this shows the solute atom fraction versus the nominal radius ratio. And the two main points I want to get across, one is that the best glasses, which are shown in red, occur at very specific radius ratios. And except for palladium silicon, they're also rather solute rich as well. And so I won't have much time to talk about the reason for that. I'm going to just skip over all this. I'll just finish with these last two points. We asked the question, why is it that the solute-rich glasses are the most stable? And we come up with two arguments. One is based on the strength of the unlike atom bonds. If you take a pink atom out and put a solute in, you break five solvent-solvent bonds, and you make one, I'm sorry, yeah, you break one alpha-omega bond and five solvent-solvent bonds. You make one alpha-alpha bond, but you make five unlike atom bonds. So the overall enthalpy for this simple atom change is shown here, and that would be enthalpically favored if four times the energy of the unlike bond is more negative than this term here. And it seems that that is a quantity that may exist in a number of different systems. And then the final point is that we also tried to calculate what relative concentrations and sizes of atoms would give the most efficient packing. As I mentioned before, there are no approaches for really calculating that, and we use what's called the Furness model. It was developed in the 1930s to develop or to establish how efficiently you pack limestone aggregate. So you think 1 meter rocks and you know 1 centimeter rocks, or I'm sorry, 10 centimeter rocks, and how do you fill space? And so we use that sort of model, and we find that these pink hatched areas are where that model would predict you get most efficient global filling of space. And the only point that I'm trying to show here is that seems to overlap roughly with the bulk metallic glasses that are observed in the binary system. So so that's the main content of the talk. I've got some of the main features here that I think uniquely describe metallic glasses from other glassy systems that that we might be considering. So thank you very much.
This is a really stupid theorist question. You showed you could calculate the coordination number of the solvent atoms and compare that with experiment. I'm just wondering what sort of experiment you do, what sort of experiment people do to measure that.
So there are diffraction experiments. For a binary system, you need to have at least three independent diffraction conditions so that you can deconvolve the pair distribution function into the three different the AA, the AB, and the BB. But if you do those different diffraction experiments in the same material and you're clever and you spend the time doing the analysis, then you can separate those out. There are people, Takeshi actually could probably answer your question much better, and Despina, I know, also does this work as well. But it's a fairly well-established technique. The issue is that you need three independent experiments for a binary system. If you go to a ternary system, now you need six different experiments, and so it becomes very, very difficult, and the data are generally only available for binary systems.
So basically, you get a structure factor, and you say everything in the first peak is a nearest neighbor, and that's your coordination number.
Yeah, what you usually do is you look at the first minimum in the partial pair distribution function, and you integrate the area of that first peak up to that minimum, mm-hmm. and then you relate that. You have to look at other factors that, again, that Takeshi and others know better than I do, but that you can relate that to the number of those types of atoms in the first shell.
So you could imagine varying your criterion a little bit and changing that number a little bit, but it's...
Yes, yeah.
Okay, this is a stupid experimentalist question.
You guys are hitting me from both sides.
So how bad can a glass former be and still be counted as a glass in your analysis?
Yeah, I should mention, so first of all, by the way, I'm not sure what you're talking about, but I think I sort of avoided talking about glass forming ability through a lot of this. I did mention
okay. So you said 8% of these pairs make glasses.
Yeah. Okay,
so
good.
That implies
yes.
A certain criteria.
Yes, okay. And what we did is we simply took data from the literature on glasses that were produced by quenching from the liquid. So no mechanical alloying, no vapor deposition, no electrodeposition. And some of those processes you can get quench rates as high as 10 to 11 maybe. So we limited to melt quenching, maximum quench rate of 10 to the 7. Typical quench rate is 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 6.
So the glass forms that have this locally icosahedral structure or icosahedra that are packed then into substructures, I mean, that you show that, do they show boson peaks, that is to say low frequency vibrations?
So 2 points. It's always a little tricky because I show these clusters, and so people think that we're talking only of icosahedra. I use icosahedra because they're the easiest to glue together. Okay. So to answer the second part then, is boson peaks, of course, are observed in metallic glasses. Is that?
Yeah, but are they more intense for these glasses where you have these superstructures because you have more mass and weakly coupled? Because that's usually the argument, boson peak is related to larger scale structures in glass forming systems.
Yeah, I haven't seen enough of the boson scattering data to know if those correlations exist or not.
You may have said this and I missed it, but for the clusters with the solute in the middle, how well defined, can you measure the partial structure factor, and how well defined is this? Would be a peak that would define that length scale between the solute atoms mediated by the surrounding solvent atoms. You show some G of R's, but I'm curious about the structure factor.
You mean the
partial structure factor for solute-solute?
Yeah.
Concentration fluctuation.
Yeah. So you're talking about, I've drawn this line here, and you're asking how broad is that really?
Well, no, that's an R space. I'm saying, can you do a diffraction experiment to get the solute-solute structure factor, partial structure factor?
Takeshi is nodding his...
But I mean, you see like a weak peak at a distance that characterizes this? Or
It depends on the system, right?
Experiments have been done only on few systems because it's a very hard experiment, and that's not my experiment either. But the German group has done a very good job, and particularly using isotopes. At some certain times that you can have negative B, therefore that you can have much more accurate structure factor. And the answer, so if you have A, B, and B is a minority, you want to see B, B, some ordering peak, right? No, you don't see it.
You don't see
any ordering? It's very, if I recall.
I mean, yeah, this is probably wrong, but so this was Lamparter's work.
Right.
That was
Etheridge and Lee. That's in G, okay? We are talking about S of Q.
Okay. Yeah.
S of Q.
Yeah. Okay.
S Q of B B. The ordering peak is seen, for instance, if you have a cyan like iron and nickel, you know, similar size with a very different chemistry, then it does show up.
Yes.
We see all the time this kind of creepy. Due to the chemistry, yeah, that's seen all the time. Yeah, that's seen all the time.
Yep.
But the geometry, for some reason, doesn't show up as
in the S of Q.
Yeah, in the S of Q.
Actually, this is a comment on the previous question. Ken was telling me the other day, with this zirconium platinum binary liquid, he actually sees a pre-peak, which may indicate the PT platinum-platinum correlation. If PT is at the center of the cluster, then we are looking at this correlation you guys are talking about. In fact, in literature, there are some aluminum glasses where you also see pre-peaks, and those pre-peaks may be related to this kind of cluster packing because it represents some kind of medium range correlation between solid
atoms. The work that I cited was aluminum cerium.
Right.
Those up.
Right. But there are some indications of this.
Okay.
In some cases, this pre-peak was seen, and then as Ma pointed out, it's our work on aluminum. Cerium ion, but it is a special case where that there are all some icosahedral order, so the peak position is really reflects 1.61, and it is not dense random packing in this particular case. And the aluminum glass is a marginal glass, as Ken has shown already. You know, it has a lot of crystalline nuclei already in it. So I would say it's an exceptional case.
Any other questions? Let me ask one last question, Dan. I like spheres also, and structures and things like that. But what about directionality? See, there are certainly in the early metalloid days, you know, like people like Phil Gaskell looked at directional coordinations. Do you think that should play a role in these things as well?
Well, okay, so
with silicon in there.
The way I read Phil Gaskell's work is that he argued strongly against directional bonding, even in the metal-metalloid systems.
Yeah.
His argument was that he saw no basis from an electronic structure perspective
right.
to expect nine-fold bonding mm-hmm. or eight-fold or ten-fold. And so, I'm not sure if he actually said it, but the way that I would look at it is that it still is roughly spherical, but the reason you have directional bonding into this cap trigonal prism is because that's a topological
right.
constraint. You have frustrated packing. But is that what you're asking, or you're...
Yeah, indeed, and not just his opinion, but just in general, what the... Maybe comment on something.
Just to comment to that, we just discussed it here with Mike. I mean, if you give them the coordinations which you have, it's a finite number of coordinations for one particular binary system you could give it to them. They could use DFT method to really measure the potential landscape, first of all, and also the directionality of that. I mean, they have the coordination numbers or the coordinates of all these atoms. You can calculate it, right, Mike?
Yes.
Yes.
It takes time and money.
But yes, I'd like to talk with you about this. My sense is that the bonding is largely non-directional. Of course, there's directionality. Take nickel zirconium, for example, and you know very well that some of the work done on the modified embedded atom metal method. So there are three-body potential terms and so on, and those are important. But it's still largely spherical in the sense that you're not motivated towards open structures like you would with a silicate. And even looking at the nickel zirconium intermetallic crystalline structures, they roughly fill space. And so there are these modifications to a spherical potential. My guess is that they don't dominate the structure that's formed. They probably definitely influence it somehow.
So I have a question on this. If you have this cluster, assume that you can form it, you have a very strong attraction to hold neighbors together to form this unit. And then you put them all together, the other atoms on the surface will interact. Put this simply, so what is the required cohesive energy you need? If you put another one in, but the atoms around the surface will be so strong interaction that will destroy your cluster. So what is the energetic requirement for you to hold the clusters together and you can arrange it in space?
Right. Okay. So the picture that I've painted for you is a rather simple picture. And in particular, I've emphasized structures where the first coordination shell had only solvent atoms. That's not the way the best glasses are. The binary bulk metallic glasses have mixed occupancy in the first shell. And so it becomes more complicated. Your question is still right. So, this atom is going to be bound to that solvent or solute, but it's also going to be bound to other atoms in the first shell and to adjacent clusters. How does all that come together to give sort of the a cohesion of the structure? And the answer is we don't know. We're working on it now. And one of the things, of course, you need to know is you need to be able to calculate what the nearest neighbors for all the atoms are. And so we're working through that now. And ultimately what we find is that in this intermediate composition range, this is all for binary systems, you find that's where the number of unlike atom bonds are maximized. And that probably leads to an enthalpic term stabilizing the structure. These numbers are surprising to us because they also look rather like curves for ideal mixing, which we know doesn't occur in these systems. And then the other thing is what happens to entropy in this region as well. And calculating entropy in these sorts of structures is, I think, an incredibly difficult task that we really don't even know how to address. But those are the sorts of things that I think need to be looked at to answer your question. And I think that that's where we need to be focusing our attention, especially on these more complex structures where you have mixed occupancy in the first shell. And when you look at the structure, it becomes, you know, this really nice picture that I painted for you about these organized clusters. You look at that, you won't even see it. You'll never see it unless you really go looking for it, because it just looks random. So it's a really difficult problem.
It's a beautiful picture, but the same. I'll make the same comment that I made to Emma. That in reality, each cluster has distortions.
Sure, absolutely.
And distortion plays as important role as this.
This is a simple static model that gives us a way of organizing our thought. But I don't really believe that this is the way the structure really, really looks. But I think somehow it's capturing some important parts of it. But these sorts of things are really, really important. So they're not hard spheres, they're soft spheres. And how does all the things that I've mentioned, how does that change when they become soft? Open question.